When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, we're over the hump.
Which hump?
Of the year. By the time this episode comes out, we'll be through the summer solstice weekend, midsummer. The days will be getting shorter again.
I know, but I find that really depressing. Why are you starting by saying that?
I just thought, here's something to look forward to. What about for midsummer solstice next year? You and I, presuming that social distancing is over, we could go to some kind of druid gathering.
You look a bit like a druid.
I think I would look great in a druid outfit.
What is a druid outfit, though?
I don't know, some kind of wizardy robes. Do you not think that would suit me?
No.
Nice and airy, get a lot of ventilation in there. On the subject of
robes,
outfits, yeah. Outfits that we last week, I can't quite remember how it came up, but we were talking about whether you had ever had a goth/emo phase.
Yeah.
And I asked if there were any reasons to be cheerful listeners who could mock up a picture of you as a goth.
Oh, and somebody did it, didn't they?
It's amazing. We got this photo from Stuart Hendry. He titled it Ed and the Millie Banshees, after Susie and the Banshees.
Yeah.
And look at that. I think this is a great look for you.
Do you think I should go for that? We're all riding my tricycle with chutney on the back. just to sort of, have the full house. I'm actually doing a test drive of the tricycle on Saturday.
Oh, hang on. We're going to put the goth to one side. Tell me more about this.
Well, I don't know. It's just, I've got swept up in sort of tricycle euphoria. And basically Justine has sort of, used the kind of relatively positive reception that the idea has got on the podcast to kind of pursue her kind of crackers maracas idea to fruition. And so now I'm going to be sort of doing the test drive tomorrow.
Oh, this is good. Will you tell us where it is? And then,
no.
I was going to say we could line the route, but of course it will have already happened by the time the podcast comes
out.
Yeah,
no, definitely. So, I'll update you as to how it goes.
What colour tricycle are you considering getting?
I don't think we're at that stage yet.
I will do for you for a very good price. If you want a Union Jack paint job on it, I'd do it for £900 million.
Thousand?
No, 900 million is how much it would cost for me to.
I see. You do it for 900 million. That's a really good thought.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll ask Boris Johnson to sort of pay for it.
Would there be any room for me on the trike? Could you get trick nuts on the back so that I could stand with my hands on your shoulders?
Well, we've had so many different emails from listeners about this that there's obviously lots of different ways. But I was absolutely smitten by an email about the pod bike. Have you seen the email about the pod bike?
Yes. Yes, I have, yeah.
So we had this email from Jan Godfrey, and it's titled Something Better Than a Tricycle. Jan lives in Stavanger in Norway. I think I've pronounced that correctly. And basically says that cycling all year round can be a bit difficult here in Norway when it gets cold and icy, but there is a solution, a pod bike. Here in Stavanger, a local engineer started a company to build a new form of electric bike with four wheels and a see-through casing. It's a bit like a small car where you sit and cycle. Even has signal lights and window wipers for when it rains. Then nearing the end of testing, it should hopefully start sales soon. You can see the website here, www.podbike.com. I mean, honestly, it's bloody expensive, but I thought it seemed great. I mean, it can go up to 25 kilometers an hour electric and up to 60 with extra pedal power.
Wow.
I mean, basically, it made me think of the Sinclair C5, which I did actually think about.
Yes!
But I thought about this some weeks ago, and I thought, whatever, why did it go wrong, the Sinclair C5?
I don't know.
So Clive Sinclair, for those who don't know, designed the ZX Spectrum, ZX81?
Of which we were both big fans.
In fact, they brought us together when we discussed the popular game Manic Miner, which I kind of got through all stages of past up to level 20. Fiji when I was a child, and it brought us together in our original first date interview, where you also asked me whether I'd ever done a Mooney, but leave that to one side, because I digress. But anyway, Clive Sinclair designed this C5, and it was sort of basically greeted with, like, massive contempt, wasn't it, the C5?
Yeah, it was a punchline, and he became a bit of a punchline. He had this idea to revolutionise transport with these. I mean, it was very much like this pod bike that you're describing.
But why?
What I'm doing now is I'm just on eBay, seeing if you can buy.
Can you?
You can get a Sinclair C5 for £360.
Are you serious?
Yes.
A one-person battery electric velomobile, technically an electrically assisted pedal cycle. Will you send me the eBay thing?
Of course I will. All I would say is when you're test driving the tricycle at the weekend, just hold off until you've also tried a pod bike and a Sinclair C5.
Yeah, I think there's something kind of retro chic about the Sinclair C5.
Yeah, it looked great with the Union Jack paint job.
Yeah. Should we talk about... I mean, honestly, I could talk for absolutely hours about this. But we probably shouldn't. Should we talk about what we're talking about?
Yes.
This week, we're returning to the question of our understanding of British history. The Black Lives Matter protests in the UK have led to renewed calls to change our approach to history in schools and in wider society. Campaigners argue that we need to both address the widespread lack of knowledge about Black British history, as well as understanding how the legacies of slavery and empire shape racial inequality today. We've talked a lot recently about our episode from last summer on teaching about the British Empire in schools, and I strongly recommend that people listen to that if they haven't. But while that's a good place to start, this week's guests have ideas for going beyond it. We're talking to Lavinia Stennett, who set up a great organisation called the Black Curriculum that teaches Black British history in schools. We're speaking to Lavinia about their work and what they're now calling for from government. Then we're talking to Richard Benjamin from the International Slavery Museum in Liverpool about how museums shape our approach to history. And finally, we're talking to Michelle Gale and Ruth Ibeg-Buna from The World Reimagined about their plans for a public art project to transform our understanding of Britain's past.
Sounds good. So what's your reason to be cheerful this week, Ed?
Well, my reason to be cheerful does actually relate to the theme of our episode, and I'd say it's a more sort of serious one than maybe some of the reasons to be cheerful of the past. But I think it is really on brand for us. And you may have noticed this. Black Lives Matter is now significantly more popular than Donald Trump in the United States. And indeed, there was a clip going round on Fox News of the right-wing host Tucker Carlson saying this. And as political scientist Drew Linzer noted, BLM is the single most favourably viewed national political organisation or politician in America right now.
Wow. Oh, that's just, I mean, it's just fantastic. And, you know, it's eating away at him as well.
I mean, don't you think that's amazing?
Yeah, that's incredible.
Now, and just in case you wonder whether this is a new thing, the answer is it is. So 62% of likely voters now have a favourable opinion of Black Lives Matter, while 32% have a very favourable one. So like a significant majority have a favourable opinion. This result represents a stunning turnaround. A similar poll conducted in June 2016, for example, found that only 37% of likely voters had a favourable view of Black Lives Matter, while a majority viewed it unfavourably. It is such an interesting thing about... I mean, obviously, you know, the horrific murder of George Floyd has led to some of this, but it must also say something about the way the movement has built popular support.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And also... Donald Trump's becoming less popular, which is also brilliant. What's your reason to be cheerful, Jeff?
Well, mine's not as good as yours, I'll be honest about it. I was struggling.
Don't worry about that. Don't feel bad about that.
And this will have been and gone by the time the episode comes out, but my reason to be cheerful is Father's Day. In particular, my son this morning, and it's Friday as we're speaking, he ran into the bedroom and he went, "Daddy, happy Father's Day for Sunday, and we're going to surprise you with a blueberry pie."
Aww.
So I already know what my surprise is going to be, and I'm extremely excited about
it. Isn't that great? I tell you, actually, this is sort of slightly off topic, but I had a sort of incident this week where we had a sort of fun family argument, and one of my children, who I won't name, refused to finish a story that they started telling.
Like the leisure centre story.
Well, exactly. He was starting to tell this story, and then he got really annoyed, and he was like, "I'm not going to tell you the end of the story." And Justine and I were saying, "Oh, please tell us the end of the story." And he's like, no, I'm not." So I then told him about the kind of, you know, fateful leisure centre story, which you had failed to failed to tell me the ending of. And I think it lightened the mood. So, you know, thanks.
Basically, you're saying my reaction to being interrupted during a story is the same as a child's.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're going to start by talking to Lavinia Stennett, who is the founder of the Black Curriculum, which is a social enterprise addressing the lack of Black British history taught in schools. Lavinia, hello. Thanks for coming on and talking to us.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you.
Well, let's start with the basics. Do you want to just tell us what the Black Curriculum is and what the story behind it coming into existence is?
Yeah, sure. So the Black Curriculum is a social enterprise that works to teach and support the teaching of Black history in schools all year round, so not just in October, in an aim to improve a sense of identity for all young people in Britain. Currently, there is no Black history on the national curriculum, and with the academisation of schools, I guess there's a lot of freedom to teach it, but we're finding that there's no impetus to teach it. So we provide teacher training, we also provide workshops in schools for young people as well, and we're campaigning, and this is why we're doing what we're doing at the moment. The story behind it, I'd say there was like a small kind of like incremental things that made me get here, but I'd say the main catalyst event was when I was in New Zealand and I studied there for 3 months, learning Indigenous land law, so Māori land law. And what struck me was just the fact that they had gone through like hundreds of years of colonialism and kind of like similar events, obviously in different contexts, with like land being like a main kind of function of, yeah, the way colonialism operated there. But they were so proud of their culture and they really immersed me in it. I was like in lectures, like with my lecturers crying and just being very open and honest about how colonialism impacted them. And I was like, we don't really have that here. Like, I feel like even in university, with people kind of telling you about the history of colonialism, it's very kind of clinical. And I didn't feel there was a lot of emotion or kind of like lived experiences involved in that. And yeah, studying there with them telling me their own experiences was just really powerful. And so I was like, right, we have to do something like this in Britain. And I came back really energized. And that's how it really started. I pulled together my friends and Bethany and Lisa, who are the two girls that have worked closely with me from the start, helped to build it. So, yeah, we're here now.
That sounds, I mean, it just sounds fantastic. It sounds like a great idea. And for people like me who don't really know about the education system and the national curriculum, can we talk a little bit more about, you touched on it there, the current situation. So October is Black History Month and some teaching happens during then. And then the other thing you were describing, it's like that there are modules, but they're optional. Can you just talk to me a little bit more about the situation that a history teacher would find themselves in with regards to Black history at the minute?
Yes, I think it really just depends on like what kind of school you're in. I think what we're seeing is that there's a very fractured education system where you have state schools, you have private schools, and with state schools, like some of them have the flexibility to teach what they want. And you find that mostly with academies, they follow their own kind of curriculum. But the national curriculum is a national curriculum and it's supposed to basically offer kind of guidelines as to what is mandatory, what teachers should be able to teach, and like what examples are important for different key stages. So from key stage 2 to key stage 4, there are no clear-cut examples of Black history or Black histories within Britain. So for example, you'd be taught the Holocaust, and yeah, there are other kind of periods, but there's no kind of like examples that are clear about Britain's role with Africa, Britain's role with Asia, for example, and the lived experiences of Black people in Britain. So because of that, what we have is that some schools, well, some teachers come from a background of like knowing this information, so they're just like, right, I'm going to teach anyway. But not all other teachers have that kind of background, and so it's very hard for them if there's no examples in the national curriculum and there's no resources that are accessible to them to teach it, they're not going to teach it. So what we find is that in October, some schools will teach Black history, but coming from a perspective of more slavery, so again just like focusing on like one side of British history, which is quite dehumanizing, but not kind of roping in other narratives that are more complex and nuanced and deserve to be taught to young people so they can understand the full picture of Britain.
And tell us, Lavinia, what kind of response do you get to the sessions you run with teachers and students on Black British history? Is there an enthusiasm for people that you find from people about filling the gaps?
So I remember our first session, our pilot in October, and there was we was in a school, so there was a lot of, like, I guess, apprehension at first. Like, who are you guys? Like, we don't know you. Who are you, like, to come in and tell us about?
Paint us a picture. Where was this school,
yeah,
Lavinia?
Yeah, okay, cool. So we went to a school in South London, and it's mainly made up of working class and BAME young people. So what we saw was that those young people were so excited to see us, but in terms of the information that we're coming in to provide, I think at first it was like, oh, let's proceed with caution. And as we started teaching, I think what we saw was like the wall starting to break down. They would like tell us about certain experiences that they've had. You saw, like, for example, in terms of like the way in which we lead our classes, it's very collaborative. And so in smaller groups, they'll be just like talking about things that they haven't had the opportunity to express before. So it was a very kind of dynamic session. There was a lot of ideas. And
so about how the history related to that, to
them.
It was not just about the history, exactly, but the way the history related to them.
To them, yeah. And what they see outside of school and what they hear on television. And I think these are things that are so key, and young people are experiencing it, but the school kind of like structure doesn't necessarily facilitate that kind of space. I'm not saying all schools, but yeah, I just think schools as a structure, it doesn't allow all young people to bring in their experiences. So in fact, it was quite liberating for many of the young people, and it's really empowering to see young people just like be really excited and take something from it and want to do more, because it doesn't just stop there.
And give us some examples of the kinds of things that you're talking to young people about, what aspects of Black history.
Yeah, so our syllabus is basically divided into like different modules. So we take a very thematic approach where we don't kind of like have history, geography, music. It's kind of all interwoven in one. So the themes is land and the environment. So we kind of teach about environmental injustices like Grenfell, but also taking a more historical approach to actually think about how the land and belonging, themes such as belonging, are kind of interconnected. So we use the example of the Bristol bus boycotts in that as well. Another module is also migration. So we kind of explore figures such as John Blanc and just historical figures, even in the Roman times, Jacques Francis, why they came here, what were their experiences like, and kind of moving on into the latter half of the 18th century to explore the role of empire in migration and what are the reasons, you know, contextualizing why people actually came to Britain. And I think that's been really common in terms of the workshops we've done. Like, everyone likes to know migration, and also art history. So there's music, and I think that's a really lovely, that's my favorite anyway. I love that module, with reggae, calypso. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Paul Stevenson there. Just, we covered it on a previous episode, but tell people a little bit about Paul Stevenson and the Bristol bus boycott, because, you know, it's always struck us that, you know, you learn about Rosa Parks, but you don't know, we don't tend to learn about what happened in Britain.
Yeah, precisely. I think there's a bit of a miseducation there in terms of what the civil rights era entailed and how inspiration was drawn, not only from America, but globally. There was different civil rights movements. And in Britain, the Bristol bus boycotts was one of the main, I guess, catalyst events for race relations in the UK. And I think even within that, there are key figures like Roy Hackett, Paul Stevenson. You had Carmen Beckford, who was like one of the first Black women to be elected to a council in Bristol to help shape that. And I think what it does for us when we understand how civil rights movements were kind of shaped here, it allows us to understand that, like, there is just a whole kind of like backlog of oppression in the UK, and the things that Black people here have done, it's not just like Martin Luther King, like, we had our own. And for me, it's just fantastic that it's not even in London, it's in Bristol, you know? And I think
Absolutely. It's
so, so key that we actually know, what Black people have done and like how their work has been enshrined now in law that allows us to be all in principle fairly treated in the UK.
And it's important, isn't it, that this just goes, you know, there's obviously an important need to teach about the history of empire and slavery. And we've talked a lot on this podcast about the fact that it isn't properly talked about. But it's important to go beyond that as well, isn't it?
100%, because I think if we just focus, again, I think we can talk about empire, but in a way where it's contextualized. So, you know, who gained the wealth? Where did the wealth go? What was the kind of wealth that came to Britain? So I think that that aspect's really important, but also just not focusing on the negatives, because, yeah, what I have seen in some of our classes as well is that it does get a bit distressing for students to just continually be faced with, like, you know, the history of oppression in Britain. It's like, can we learn something positive? So I do think just roping in really positive examples and icons and pioneers within Black histories is really key as well. And it allows young people to see that there are many things that they can aspire to, all young people as well. And it's not just Black people were slaves.
On the issue of what you're calling for from government, say something about what you're asking the government to do in terms of the national curriculum on Black British history.
Yeah, so we're asking the government at the moment to meet with us to discuss how we can embed Black histories into the curriculum, from citizenship to PSHE to history, and also English, so that we take a wider approach from Key Stage 1 to Key Stage 4, so that we don't have to, I guess, rely on individual teachers to do this work, but there's a policy that says this is mandatory, and I think that is really important. So that is what our campaign is focused on doing, to embed Black histories into the national curriculum. We've had support from over 50 MPs. Thousands of people have downloaded and emailed their own MPs, emailed Gavin Williamson, to support our TPH 365 campaign, which stands for Teach Black History 365. The deadline is Monday, which is the 22nd Windrush Day. And we're hoping to seek a response from Gavin Williamson to have a meeting to discuss what we could do to change the national curriculum in that sense and embed Black history. But I think in terms of actually just supporting our work, it is about raising the awareness, petitioning their schools to have us in their schools, also encouraging teachers to take up our teacher training and also donating. And everything is on the website, which is www.theblackcurriculum.com.
And if teachers are listening to this and think, well, that sounds really good, give us sort of an example or two of what other teachers have done to sort of take this up, so because it might, you know, it might inspire others.
Okay, so in terms of taking up our program, what we encourage teachers to do is continue that learning, because I do think it is, like, it's so vital that teachers are able to connect with each other and share that learning post our sessions. So one of the kind of feedbacks that we've got from teachers is that they are starting to embed more Black histories into their classes through visual images, through using different resources, so not just books, like using videos on YouTube, and just like weaving in different examples, ensuring that there's like a wide range of literature that's out there, and there's more representation for students. So again, like bringing us in, so that students can actually see that, look, I can do this with my life as well, and this is what Black people in Britain are doing.
Can I just ask about you, Lavinia? What were you doing before you got involved in this? And how you've said very interestingly at the beginning about how you got involved in it. But what were you doing before? How, you know, what's the experience been like?
Yeah, so I literally graduated from SOAS last year, July, and at the time of founding the Black Curriculum, I was in the middle of my dissertation. So we founded last year, January, and yeah, like, I've literally just gone from uni straight into this. So this is like my full-time work at the moment.
And what's the experience like? Rewarding? Frustrating?
A mix.
Equal measure of both?
It's a mix. Like, sometimes I'm just like, oh, this is really, really heavy and it's much bigger than me. But at the same time, I feel like it just gives me a purpose and, yeah, helps me to just want to just do more.
Well, Lavinia Stennett, it's incredibly inspiring what you're doing. I'm sure you'll get lots of our listeners who are interested in I hope, trying to support your campaign. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, to take the conversation on, recent weeks have seen renewed calls for a new national museum to document the British Empire and the UK's role in the transatlantic slave trade. There already is an international slavery museum in Liverpool, and I'm glad to say that we're joined by the head of it, Dr. Richard Benjamin. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
So for those who don't know, what is the International Slavery Museum and how long has it been around?
Yeah, well, it is a national museum, so you're quite right there. Maybe the name doesn't always help because it's international, but we are actually a, you know, DCMS funded national museum on the subject. We opened in 2007, so on the 23rd of August, which was big year for the UK. It was the bicentenary of the abolition of the Slave Trade Act. So there was a lot of activity in the UK, which I know you'll be aware of. So we were funded to open in that year. But just one thing I would say is it kind of came about from what was called the Transatlantic Slavery Gallery. And that was in the Merseyside Maritime Museum since the early 90s. But it was a gallery. It wasn't a proper museum as such. So when we opened, we got the status of being a national museum.
And why is it particularly important to have a slavery museum in Liverpool?
Well, look, Liverpool was the epicentre of the transatlantic slave trade from, you know, the 18th century to the 19th century. I mean, Bristol and London were, of course, involved as well, as were many smaller towns, you know, such as Whitehaven, etc. And a lot of scholars have written a lot of research on that. But there had been a long narrative in Liverpool, a narrative that had started way back in, you know, the 80s, that was about there being a facility in Liverpool that spoke honestly about the city's history and the Liverpool's black community. And that was led by black activists who then worked with people in the museum and they said, OK, we want a museum here. And that's how it came about.
And for those of us who are a bit ignorant, probably I include myself in this, about Liverpool's role in the slave trade, you say you were the epicentre. Say a bit more to us, Richard, because I think our listeners will find it interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, there's the triangular trade, so that ships were fitted out with cargo and goods in various UK ports. And then they set sail to various parts of West Africa and people were enslaved there. And obviously, a lot of people have documented how horrendous that was. And then people would have been forcibly taken to the Americas, and that's everywhere from Cuba to North America. Numbers-wise, well, you'll get some historians saying that there were 11, 12 million people who were enslaved, taken over the Middle Passage. And that'll go up to some scholars saying that's over 50 million, and it's still very debatable. Ships that left Liverpool engaged in this trade, you're looking at upwards of 4,000. So, you know, that's a lot of ships over a lot of years. And a lot of people, influential people, mayors of the city, were engaged in this as well. So,
and over what period would that have taken place, Richard?
Yeah, well, you're looking at 75 to 100 years. So, you know, from the, you know, 1699 was the first slaver ship that went to Barbados from Liverpool. But then it grew. London and Bristol kind of had more slaver ships first that left for many years. But then Liverpool took over, took it to a new level. And that's why Liverpool became the epicentre until the abolition of slavery in 1807.
That's really helpful and interesting. How do you think museums can help, in terms of your experience at the International Slavery Museum, how do they help to shape our understanding of the past, and what role can they play in addressing the kind of unexplored parts and maybe the kind of airbrushed parts of British and world history?
Well, look, most museums will tell you this, and we'd say this in Liverpool, that, you know, we're storytellers. You know, we tell stories and you engage people with those stories. But equally, it's who the stories have been spoken by. So you're trying to give a voice to people that have often been voiceless. So with someone like the Slavery Museum, we say it's very much African agency. We try to have the voice coming from people who are African or the descendants of people who are African. It isn't necessarily a Eurocentric starting point, which is often the case, and that's why there's a big issue within the country at the moment about decolonising museum spaces and decolonising statues and decolonising curriculums. It's whose voice you're hearing, isn't it? And that's often not a diverse voice. And museums are educational, you know. That's part of what they do. It's your USP. It's to bring people together to educate, particularly younger people, so that they can be citizens with a broad understanding of British and world history. So we at the Slavery Museum, that's a big part of what we do. We've had hundreds of thousands of young people come through the doors, 4 million visitors in total. And we're quite a provocative museum. You know, we talk about the legacies of slavery. We have a standpoint. You know, we do believe that issues around racism and various forms of oppression today, hate crime, that they have their roots in the transatlantic slave trade and attitudes that were kind of shaped then.
Given that there could be some tough facts that visitors are confronted with, how do you go about getting people across the door in the first place.
You have that debate, should you enjoy a trip to something like the International Slave Museum? You make it interactive. You know, that's why you have education session or handling session. So, you know, we have a great education team, a learning and participation team, who are very engaging individuals, you know. So even though the subject matter is incredibly serious, you know, when you're talking about human rights and, you know, the legacies of slavery, but you do it in an engaging manner and you have to be very good at your job to be able to do that. And as a team, I would like to think we're kind of very accessible. So a lot of it is to do with how you are yourself and how you act. The International Slave Museum's located in a larger Merseyside Maritime Museum. We're a separate museum, but we're in the same building. And we're on the Royal Albert Dock, which is the most visited part of Liverpool, now that it's you know, a lot different than it was in the 90s. So you've got over 2 million, 3 million visitors that come to Liverpool as a city generally, and a lot of those people go to the Albert Dock.
On something you mentioned there, the legacy of slavery and how it, the repercussions and how it affects Britain today. Tell us a bit more about your approach to telling that story and getting people to think about that.
Yeah, well, we've always, the way we've gone about it, and I'm not saying everyone's always agreed with this, we've tried to make it very personal. So, for instance, I've talked about our education programme. So all museums have educational spaces, you know, they all have that. But in the ISM, ours is called the Anthony Walker Education Centre. And I'm sure you and your listeners will know this. So Anthony Walker, young black man, murdered just outside Liverpool over 10 years ago, almost 15 years ago now. And we spoke with his family, G. Walker, Dominique Walker, before we opened. And we said, look, we might be using some images or some footage of Anthony's life. And we didn't necessarily need permission to do that. Museums often get, you know, copyright and permission. But we wanted to do it different. And we said to the family, are you happy with this? And they understood what we were trying to do. And we've got a long, we've had a relationship with them since 2007. I'm a trustee of the Anthony Walker Foundation. I have been for a decade. And we named our education room after Ample. We're a hate crime reporting centre. You know, and you know, how many museums can say that they're a hate crime reporting centre? It's not what museums do, but it's what we do, because we want to be part of the fight against racism and discrimination. Let's do that. So that's an example of how we like to go about things.
And when you think about other countries and the relationship they have with their sort of colonial past and slavery, can you look around the world and see other former countries which benefited from the slave trade, who've sort of got a better grasp on that?
Yeah, I wish I could say yes, to be honest with you, but I don't know if that is the case. I think a lot of this is to do with certain institutions, museums often, and individuals, activists, historians, who've kind of taken on that role. You know, I spent a lot of time in the US, and one would think that maybe the US would have this system of education which would be very open and honest. Now, it depends what state you're in. Some of them don't talk about it, others may mention it. Over here, we've got the national curriculum. It's not compulsory, and we've got a national curriculum, which is a very good national curriculum. But I'm not going to say how old I am, but I remember I was the first year that did GCSEs, and I can't remember much about transatlantic slavery in the education that I had.
You know, the wake of events following the killing of George Floyd and you know, the protests and conversations that have been had, there are calls from some people for a new British Museum of Empire or of slavery. Do you think we need museums like yours in different parts of the country to help people get to grips with the past?
Well, look, there's two things here. One, I tell people openly, we're a national museum. We're funded by DCMS going. And I know how difficult it is to get to that stage, because I've been trying to get there for 10 years with colleagues. So if I'm being, and I'm a pragmatist, so is there going to be another large-scale museum of that amount? No, I don't think there is. So let's be practical about it. Should there be facilities within the cities, whether in existing museums or even new facilities that are museums, that discuss more openly the city's role? Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we, for instance, have a dialogue with people in Glasgow, for instance, who've been kind of grappling with this discussion. for a number of years as well, as Bristol and London have. But Glasgow, have, in most recent years, it's been very vocal. So we work with community activists in Glasgow. We've advised on some of the work that we've done. We work with the museum service there. We work with their equivalent of the city council there. And we're not the oracle of everything, but we've been through it. And we know that it's about trust. These discussions are long and sensitive. So what I would say is, do I think there needs to be another national museum? No. Just because we're not in London doesn't mean you can't be a national museum. We're in Liverpool and we're a national museum. Should there be more investment maybe and more facilities focused on slavery and empire in the cities you've just mentioned? Yes. And I would be happy. We would be happy to partner with them. But it was a long, hard fight to get where we are in Liverpool. And I meant no excuses for that. You know, we're a national and we're looking to move on ourselves.
Well, look, Richard, you've really presented an inspiring story about the work that you're doing at the International Slavery Museum. We hope that this podcast will encourage those people who haven't visited to come and visit.
I'm in Liverpool quite often. I've never been, and I'm definitely going to come the next time I'm up.
Oh yeah, well, coffee and cake for you if you do come. There you go.
Definitely then, yeah.
And coffee and cake for all of our listeners. Thank you, Richard Benjamin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And finally, we're going to talk about a brilliant project called World Reimagined with Ruth Ibeg-Buna, who's a social entrepreneur, and Michelle Gale, who you know as well as many other things, has been a singer and an actor. Hello, both.
Hello.
And Michelle, you know, we know you from the pop charts and from EastEnders, but we just before we started recording, we were trying to figure out if Ed and I are slightly too old to have seen you in Grange Hill. And I think Ed is, but I'm not, excitingly.
He always rubs it in, Michelle.
Sorry,
honestly.
Ed, for being so old.
Yeah, he just always makes me feel like I'm of a different generation than him.
So Gonch was one of your classmates then?
Yes, that's right. In fact, he was my boyfriend, Gonch, for a little bit. We dated in the Grange Hill world.
And was Mrs. McCluskey the head teacher then?
Yes, she was.
Yeah. Okay. This is all starting to sound very familiar to me. So can we start just asking you about the World Reimagined? Do you want to tell us what it is and what it will involve?
Yes, the World Reimagined, it's a mass participation art education project where if you can visualise 100 globes across cities in the UK that will reflect different themes surrounding the transatlantic slave trade. And that is because we will be teaching people that we work with working with artists, working with communities and schools to educate everything around the transatlantic slave trade, including what Africa was like before slavery, up until what the transatlantic slave trade experience was actually like, and then digging further into what it means to be Black and British in this country. We want to be able to celebrate being Black and British, and I think many Black British people feel reticent about that. They feel unwanted. They feel that their history hasn't been told and has actually been ignored, and it's very hard sometimes to go, proudly, I'm Black and British. And this is a moment for us, we see, to be able to celebrate being Black and British. And that's why so many of the globes will also honour descendants of slaves who have done well despite the system that is sometimes so stacked against them.
Do you want to tell us a little bit, both of you, about how you came to be involved in it and why it was something that you felt passionate about doing personally?
Yeah, I think we've got the same key person, haven't we, Ruth? You can start.
Yeah. I was approached by someone I've worked with in the past called Dennis, who was working with a great group of people who'd already been working on this for a couple of years. I have a background. I was a teacher for many years and then subsequently worked with a lot of young people, especially a lot of Black young people in the north of England who felt that their education had not told them anything. You know, we read To Kill a Mockingbird and everyone feels very good about the role that, you know, Atticus Finch played. And then we maybe for Black History Month talk about Rosa Parks for a week and then we move on. That's it. And a lot of Black people, especially Black young people, feel there's no point in their education where they felt proud, were allowed to feel proud of their heritage. So that's what really drew me into this. I wanted to do something for the young people that I represent, where they can actually go to school and come home and feel like, wow, I learned something about Africa before slavery.
I was at an event with Andrew Melengeni, who had been incarcerated with Nelson Mandela. And I was sitting beside Dennis, the same key person, and he sparked this conversation that I'd actually realized until that day I'd never had with a white person before. So he said to me, you know, it's really weird because he's got one parent that's German and one parent that's South African. It said it's just really weird that they've had their truth and reconciliation in those countries, so to speak. But he just felt that Britain had never really come to terms with their role in the transatlantic slave trade. And I thought, I agree with you. These are conversations that I've been having with Black British people for years and years and years. And it was just really interesting to hear a white person saying it. And he said that he wanted to introduce me to people that he was working with within that space that wanted to have that conversation, difficult as it may be, and introduce it to a wider spectrum. And that's what we think art is important. If you see these globes in public spaces, it makes you engage and be inspired by art. And then we're just a doorway into, you know, the wider education into it. So you look into it, you can go online to some of the programs we'll be offering online and some films we hope to make with partners. But it means that we give you a kind of engagement that you wouldn't necessarily have had with that subject.
Ruth, often this country, the British conversation around the slave trade, it focuses on abolition. Why do you think we're so bad at discussing the less comfortable parts of Britain's past? And do you want to tell us a bit more about the aspects of the slave trade and these globes that the World Reimagined is going to be exploring?
Of course, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. My dad is Nigerian, and one thing he always used to tell me growing up is the British are very bad at difficult conversations and they'll do everything to avoid them. And this is the ultimate difficult conversation, isn't it, really? You know, no one comes out of this looking very good. And as Michelle said before, it's interesting talking to German friends about the fact their country had to do the work. They've got things in their recent history that don't make them feel very proud, but the young people go through school, learn about that, and therefore learn never to repeat those same mistakes again. In this country, we paint ourselves as the saviours of slavery. You know, when you study in the curriculum, it's all about how we abolish slavery. And a lot of young people internalise that and go off into the world thinking, well, you know, Britain did a good job there. It got rid of slavery for the black people. You know, why are you complaining? And what's really interesting is the pushback that black people get when they talk about Britain's role in slavery is that people almost get irritated with them. Because it's like, you know, yeah, but we're not the bad guys in this. And that's just an educational piece. We need to understand that actually Britain made a lot of money from slavery. It was key and integral in what happened. Millions of Africans died. And that is a somber moment for us not to just push past and forget. And it feels like this whole, you need to get over slavery. We've never had the conversation that's enabled us to get over it. We've never talked about how we feel about that. And I think for me, there's also something about slavery being pushed into a black history box. It's not black history. It's everyone's history. It's white history as much as black history. And so this whole project is about how do we open it up so that everyone feels that they can enter into something quite difficult and have a conversation and extricate themselves from it feeling a bit better about it.
And Michelle, what is the role of art and culture in opening up this conversation about our history? You know, if you like, going beyond formal, I mean, we've been talking on the episode about the education people get in, kids get in schools, but what's the role of art and culture beyond formal education?
Because when you learn about something, once you have to get into the artistic mode, it means you have to empathize with that subject. In order for you to be able to translate artistically onto that globe, your impression of the subject, you have to have some kind of emotional connection before you can do that. And we think that empathy drives this whole conversation. The need to be able to understand and empathize with the pain that so many people have carried for so many years. And that's why we think art is really a crucial way of building that empathy.
And Ruth, do you think that there is currently more appetite to rethink our approach to British history?
You see, that's a really interesting one, because if you look at the news and you look on social media, you would say yes. You know, people's books on race and racism are selling out, and it feels like a real moment where Britain's open to this. But if you also look on social media and look at the backlash from people who were saying they don't want to talk about Black Lives Matter, slavery's moved on, let's get over it. I think there are more people willing to have this conversation and there's a lot of curiosity. I think a lot of young people are pushing to learn more. But I think there will be a backlash because people feel resentful sometimes and feel like this is not my problem. Why are we dealing with this? I didn't do this. And I think there's something that Michelle said about empathy, not necessarily feeling personal guilt, but just understanding a process and therefore having deep empathy for someone who doesn't look and sound like you.
And now the art project is taking place the summer after next. I think that's right, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So it's 2022.
Summer 2022. I think lots of people will be listening to this and feeling really inspired. How can people get involved, support what you're doing and all of that?
Perfect. Yes. You can sign up on our website, which is www.theworldreimagined.org. You can sign up, get our newsletter. Those people that want to be involved with organisations on the sponsorship level, we have loads of different opportunities. So please just get in touch there and let's talk. But we're very, as you can tell, infused about it and just raring to go.
Ruth?
Yeah, and I've had community artists contact me, and what's been really interesting was when this first started, there was, we had a lot of interest in London, and we've been contacted by people in communities in Cardiff, in Newcastle, in other areas, saying we've got stories to tell as well about slavery. It's not just about Liverpool and Bristol and London. So what's been really interesting is actually connecting with people in areas that you wouldn't necessarily associate with the slave trade who have realised that they also have stories and narratives that they want to share as part of our project.
And if there are people in communities around this country who are like really, really enthused, and I'm sure there will be by this, you know, that you can sort of match them up to an artist, yes?
That's right, yes. So if you're a community organisation, you get in contact with The World Reimagined. We try and link you up with an artist, hopefully a local one, but if not, one that really resonates with what you want to tell. And then that artist will work with the community to then transfer their ideas and decorate that globe together. So it's them participating in how they want to interpret everything that they've learned. It's the same with schools too. That's what we're having with schools, is an artist will then go into the schools, speak with the children and the teachers, and they then determine how that globe will look.
Sounds absolutely brilliant. Ruth Ibeg-Buna and Michelle Gale, thanks so much for joining us and good luck with your project.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What did you think, Jeff?
I thought it was a brilliant conversation. I feel like I learned a lot during it. And something I was struck by from talking to Lavinia and also talking to Ruth and Michelle is that if you are a black person growing up and living in this country, you know, there's the sense that you know that history and an incredible frustration and disconnect that history isn't currently part of the country's story and the way it's taught in history. And I think we've heard some brilliant ideas about changing that.
You're right. I suppose a couple of things struck me. I think Lavinia talking about what was happening in schools when the history part of this was taught and the way in which the students related it to the contemporary experience, I think is really interesting because, you know, we think, okay, let's go and teach some history, but history isn't just important to be taught. It's important because of what it sort of opens up about contemporary experiences that people are going through. And I thought that was really interesting. And I was really struck that, you know, neither you nor I knew about the International Slavery Museum. I mean, that says something. And I mean, maybe I'm struck in the episode a couple of weeks ago, you know, we were talking in general about the issues, but also what are the practical things that we can do? And I think we do know some things from this episode we can do. We can support the Black British History campaign. We can go and visit the Slavery Museum. And we can also support and get involved in Michelle and Ruth's absolutely brilliant project.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
If you've got thoughts about this week's episode, please do get in touch with us. We read every email. We covet them. We chuckle at them, we learn from them. You can find us at cheerfulpodcast.com and you can email us. This one comes from Dave Egan and it's the subject of adult trike. As you can tell, I'm a bit obsessed. Hi, Jeff and Ed. With the talk of Ed getting an adult trike, may I suggest a style that is very popular over here in Germany? News has reached Germany about my adult trike. There are two wheels at the front with a box between them, which can be used to ferry children. Though Ed's boys might be a bit old by now. Shopping, picnics, important government papers. I wish I had those. And dare I say it, the ingredients to make your own sandwiches. Here is a link to the company that makes them in the UK. Other companies are available to give you an idea. That's Cargo Bike. They're more stable than a two-wheeler and maybe a bit cooler than a normal trike. Well, that is interesting and is important to try and be cool. Keep up the good work. Dave from Berlin, would you maybe go in that little bit of the box at the front, Jeff?
I could... Happily, yeah. It makes me think about, you used to
supermarket
see motorbikes with sidecars.
Oh, no. Yes.
Well, it's like a supermarket truck.
Or Dastardly and Muttley. Do you remember Dastardly and Muttley?
Yes. Yeah, of course I do. Yeah,
so does that mean I'm Dastardly and you're Muttley?
Oh, yeah, didn't stop the pigeon.
Chase the pigeon.
Stop the pigeon.
Stop the pigeon or chase the pigeon?
I think it was stop the pigeon, yeah.
Right, okay, over to you.
All right, this comes from Imogen Seba, who says, she addresses this to me and says, I hope your enviable new bike and helmet, your reason to be cheerful this week. Well, I didn't want to go on about it, Imogen. Imogen continues, I'm the cyclist that so rudely, though accidentally, separated you and Sarah at the traffic lights in Angel today.
Wow.
So we went for a bike ride yesterday. This is when we saw Imogen.
Because you're really into your bike, aren't you, now?
Well, I just got it this week. It was the first time we've been out.
Because
I'd been out on the street bikes, the hire bikes, and this was the first time we've been out on our own bikes.
So you've
really
just bought a bike, have you?
Well, I kind of got a friend.
Oh, you got the free bike, yeah. And how is it?
Yeah, yeah. It's great. It's really wonderful.
It's electric,
yesterday, actually. It's just a normal push bike.
Right.
Anyway, so I was cycling yesterday and somebody shouted, I was just listening to your podcast this morning. And it was Imogen. And this caused me to become separated from Sarah, and because neither of us Sarah used to cycle in New York, but she'd never really cycled in London. We're not sure what to do at junctions. We don't know how to turn right on a main road, so she'd gone on way ahead whilst I had a chat with Imogen, who was also a new cyclist, like a lot of people have become during lockdown. She said she'd been cycling for a couple of weeks. She says, cycling through central London in the middle of a weekday is an upside of furlough leave, which I've been on since Easter. I normally work in theatre. With many of my friends and colleagues from this industry under threat of redundancy and some already laid off, I wonder if at this crunch point you could look into some reasons to be cheerful for the arts. In France and Germany, orchestras and theatres are planning for socially distant reopenings, with some already rehearsing. And the arts centre I work for, as well as many others in the UK, are making creative packs for 3,000 children in our borough who wouldn't otherwise have access to things like arts and crafts. Amidst bleak news stories about theatres being shut for months to come, can you do your thing and give us some reason to be cheerful? Yeah,
you know,
I can tell you're about to say it's a great idea. I know you're a huge...
It is a great idea. It's a great idea. There's an absolutely massive threat to the creative industries, which are an incredibly proud part of our country, an important part of our country. So I think it's a great idea. I think we should sort of act on it. This one comes from Lucy Charlton. This is really exciting, actually, this one. All of them are exciting, but this is exciting too. This is called Being Bear Aware, sort of. Dear Ed and Jeff, my husband and I are living in Canada at the moment, down by a river in our van. Came back from a really long trip. We hitchhiked from Cambodia to England, then had to rush back to Canada because otherwise we would be split up due to COVID, long story. Anyway, while waiting for our spousal sponsorship to be accepted, he works and I have a lot of time to paint and work on my portfolio. One day I was told there was a mother bear and two baby cubs 50 metres down the road from me. I didn't really know what to do as I was way too hot to sit in the van all day. So I blasted 3 episodes of Reasons to be Cheerful and sat and painted. Just thought you'd like to know that I was sat being comforted by your lovely voices and hoping that the bear thought I had lots of friends around so it didn't want to come and explore. Was really inspired by the people and always appreciate the great and positive podcast. Here's some pictures of our social isolation in the van and what I was working on. Hope you're both well. Best wishes, Lucy and Daniel. But he's off guarding in torrential rain. I mean, that's quite a story, isn't it?
Incredible.
We kept the bears at bay.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet at Cheerful Podcast.
We're in the outro.
We are. Now, can I ask you something?
I don't know.
Will you get a member of your family to use their phone to video you test driving this tricycle?
Possibly, but if I do, it will go into the vault along with the trampoline and the Icelandic hot tub video.
You know what is exciting is
with those very strange noises. Yeah,
yeah. The what's exciting is that they've said that gigs could be making a comeback, but drive-in gigs, and you'll be able to get some gigs in your tricycle.
Or the Sinclair C5.
Or the Sinclair C5, yeah.
Do you think you have to plug them in, the Sinclair C5? Presumably you do.
To charge it, but that's the same with electric cars.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but I wonder whether that's the other aspect of this, which is that people just thought, well, what, you know, that's the whole business. We, you know, in a way that you wouldn't think now, like plugging in an electric car or whatever, you know what I mean?
You're saying Sir Clive was a visionary.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know. Let's see whether maybe I can test drive a C5.
If anybody can hook Ed up with a C5, let us know, please. We should mention our newsletter, by the way.
Yeah, we should mention our newsletter, definitely.
Newsletter. It is the highlight of many people's weeks already, and that could apply to you too. But you have to sign up first. Lots of extra material on the subjects we cover in the podcast, and you can sign up at cheerfulpodcast.com.
It's like the bonus bits, but you don't have to pay for them.
That's right.
You know, you just get it like into your email inbox, you know, no questions asked, going deeper into the episode. What more could you ask for?
Well, we should thank the exceptional Zoe Gelber, who puts together the newsletter for us.
I'd like to thank our guests, Jeff, Lavinia Stennett, Richard Benjamin, Michelle Gale, and Ruth Ibegbuna.
Our podcast is produced by our friend Emma Corsham, with research from the fantastic Joel Pearce, with backup from the aforementioned Zoe Gelber and Fanula DC and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music. James Deacon made the idents, and the artwork was designed by
Henry Cull.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.